Welcome to Virtual Economy, a podcast about the business of games for the rest of us. We're your hosts. I'm Michael Footer.
And I'm Amanda Farrow.
In each episode, we'll cover the biggest business beats and bring in expert commentary from lawyers, analysts, and industry pros. And we have some news about us.
We have some news on top of the news. Hey, I heard you like news, so I put some news on your news.
Ooh.
All right, so we have a new format that we've been experimenting with. We started last week where we separated out our news show from our interview. We had been pairing them up, and things were mostly okay. Like you all seem to really like our news, and you seem to really like our interviews. So we're like, all right, well, what if we gave you a double dose? So that's how we're going to be moving from here on out. Is our Thursday show is going to be dedicated to going over the news. And we have a lot to go over today. This is another financial heavy episode for us. And tomorrow, we are going to be publishing our episode with Ryan Canuel.
Mm-hmm. And from Petrichor Games.
From Petrichor Games to have a conversation about indie games. And man, I could just talk about indie games all day, every day. So it's really nice to have a bunch of indie developers chatting with us.
I'm really excited to talk to Ryan. The one thing I do want to say about the new format is that, yes, we're definitely going to be doing two shows. We'll do a news show. We'll do the interview show as often as we can. And hopefully that's going to continue to be every week. Mm-hmm. The timing of those right now, Thursday, Friday seems to actually work really well. It heads into the weekend. People can listen to them back to back. They can pick and choose. So right now we're going to stick with that format. But if we get some feedback, if it's better for us to space things out, if you have some thoughts about how you'd like us to see the schedule work out a little bit, please let us know. We're really interested to hear from you.
Absolutely. All right. Well, let's jump into the news. We got a lot going on. Like we said, it's another financial heavy episode. We have a lot of news around the big UE5 tech demo.
Yeah, that's a big beat.
That's going to be a big beat. But let's start off with talking about cancellations and events and everything like that, just to keep everyone apprised on what's going on mm-hmm. in the game industry. So we've heard that Paris Games Week, which was scheduled for October 23rd through 27th, and Tokyo was canceled. And Tokyo Game Show is going fully digital, so they will be holding a digital event in place of their show, which was originally supposed to be in person between September 24th and 27th. Mm-hmm. China Joy, however, is still happening. We don't have dates for that yet, but it's
July 31st.
It's July 31st?
That's when it's scheduled to start,
yeah. Okay, so that is still happening, but that's live.
It is, and that's a curious choice, because on one hand, we've got Europe that... You know, again, this was a government decision that canceled Gamescom, or that led the Gamescom organizers to cancel the in-person event and shift to a digital event. You've got Paris Games Week, which is all the way in late October, saying, you know what?
Not going to happen. Not worth the headache.
We've got Tokyo Game Show, which typically is the last big beat of what we'd consider the summer con series, because it happens after Gamescom and PAX happens. You know, you've got a couple weeks of break and then it's TGS.
And then TGS, yeah.
But yeah, China Joy is still happening. We, you know, I think right now the last thing on the schedule in the West is PAX.
It'll be PAX, and it's also BlizzCon. Those are the two last biggies for the year. We also have New York City Comic Con.
Yeah, New York Comic Con. So, right. So, we've got PAX West, which is this year, first week in September.
Right.
So, it's later than usual.
That's right, because of the way Labor Day hits this mm-hmm. year.
We've got New York Comic Con, which is October.
Yes. And we also have BlizzCon, which typically happens in the first week of November.
And then
usually directly after Halloween.
And that takes us to PAX Unplugged, which is, again, early this year, like it was the very first year they ran it, and it takes place the week before Thanksgiving. So there are still some dates that are on the calendar, but I think at this point, my heart has said goodbye to PAX.
To PAX West.
Yeah, to PAX West. I don't know if PAX Unplugged is going to happen, but I would be shocked if we end up in Seattle.
I would be shocked if we end up in Seattle as well. It's too bad, because PAX West is my absolute favorite show of the year. But, you know, it's better to keep people safe. It's mm-hmm. better to keep employees safe as well. So, yeah, that's what's going on in the world of events. More and more events are being canceled or being moved to digital.
And part of that is Jeff Keighley putting together this Summer Games Fest event series, you know, there this week, he talked with Tony Hawk, and there was the announcement of the, they called it remastered, and
that's, I'm looking at this, remaster. It looks
like remakes.
This looks like a very Capcom way of making a remaster.
Sure, I think that's a great comparison. So we got Tony Hawk 1 and 2 collected, it's $40. What's really cool is they've licensed out all the, or not, I don't know if it's all, but a lot of the original skaters, and a lot of the original music.
Yeah.
And I'm telling you that $40 for that much licensing effort is, for two games, this is great. Now, obviously, we haven't played them yet. We don't know, you know, how it's going to stack up to the original.
I need them in my veins. I need them directly in my veins, and I need that skateboard deck above our door.
Yes, and we did, in fact, manage to order the collector's edition so that Manda could have her skateboard deck. I'm excited about that. The other big thing that came out of Jeff's Summer Game Fest announcements was something that I really liked from a nerding out perspective, but I thought it was a curious choice. Yesterday, Jeff and Tim Sweeney and a couple of members of the Epic team announced Unreal Engine 5.
They didn't just announce it, they showcased it.
They showcased it with a playable tech demo.
Which I think was the first time that one of the Unreal Engine tech demos has been a fully playable experience that, according to Epic, changes each time that you play it.
Yes. And we'll talk a little bit about kind of the cool tech stuff behind that, but I actually dug into some history about UE4 and timing, because I think it's relevant to the conversation. So we're right now, you know, this was announced on May 13th, 2020. New consoles are going to launch the holiday of 2020. We're going to see UE5 in preview early 2021, and full release is planned for late 2021. Now, I just want to compare this relative to console cycles. So again, we're seeing an engine demo, or the engine revealed the same year for UE5 as mm-hmm. the console cycle. Yeah. Now, for UE4, it was announced at GDC 2012, which was a full year and a half before the last console cycle. And the Infiltrator demo, which is the one that most people remember from UE4, was a year later. Right. So that demo, which was not playable, that was a scripted in-engine demo, as opposed to what we saw yesterday with that Tomb Raider-esque.
That was heavy Tomb Raider.
It was. That was the same year as UE4's release. And then we started seeing, you know, there were some UE3 games that popped up early in the console cycle. But we started seeing, the one thing that I didn't confirm, and I'm doing that right now, UE4 was released in March of 2014. So UE4 wasn't even released until after the console cycle.
So that's pretty on par with what we're seeing with this console life cycle as well.
With the exception of preview is going to be around the same relative timing. So that preview we can expect to see in probably around March 2021. Would not surprise me if the UE5 preview was timed around GDC.
Huh, wouldn't that be curious? And by curious, I mean entirely and completely predictable, as it should be.
So, Manda, let's talk a little bit about what we saw yesterday and kind of the things that jumped out to us as both positives in the engine itself and some strangeness in the vehicle and manner of announcing.
All right, well, let's talk first about some positives, because there were a number of really cool things that we saw yesterday, up to and including just how utterly gorgeous everything looked. The thing that really struck me from yesterday was the inclusion of dynamic lighting,
mm-hmm.
which in UE5 is known as Lumen,
mm-hmm.
and the virtualized geometry, which are nanites.
Yes.
So what this does is that, based on what Sweeney was talking about and based on what I understood from the demo. Now, remember, even though my background is in computer science, it is not in graphics. I was heavy on the business side of things, even when I was in software. So what I understood is that because of this technology, game developers are now able to bring in cinematic quality 8K textured assets into UE5 in the same kind of way that filmmakers are using the Unreal Engine. Now, Unreal Engine, as we know, has also been used in Disney's The Mandalorian. So being able to create dynamic lighting and having that dynamic lighting not chew up a ton of processing power, because lighting is really processor intensive, like extremely processor intensive for the GPU.
Which is why when you look at your settings, it's the shadow settings, the dynamic lighting, reflections, that sort of thing is what eats up a lot of the...
And then even moving into the next gen technology of ray tracing, it's important to recognize just how much of a drain it is on GPU resources for lighting. The fact that it is now considered dynamic within the new Unreal Engine is going to cut down on the processing power required for, you know, outputting lighting in general. They're not going to have to worry about, do we have too many textures? Is this too rich? What are we going to do about the lighting in this particular level? Can we move it while the player is moving? You know, we talked about this yesterday, like the capability that this will instill in puzzles, in puzzle games, and for level designers, like what they'll be able to do with bouncing lights off of things. And it's just, it was just so beautiful and so incredible, and I don't think I've ever seen a game look cinematic. And by cinematic, I don't mean like, wow, this is like Heavy Rain. I mean like...
I was about to make a David Cage joke.
I always make David Cage jokes. I love Heavy Rain, but we don't need to talk about that right now, even though I know it's deeply problematic. My point with that is that this looked like it could be a movie that had a video game character in it. Can you imagine if they sat back and they're like, hey, what if we made another Assassin's Creed film?
Oh, yeah.
Couldn't that, like, I mean, they could blend the two. They could blend these things together so that Assassin's Creed, like Assassin's Creed, the Viking game that they're going to be coming out with, you know, what if they made it so that you could make these in-game films and then you could release them and they look cinematic as heck?
Sure. And I think about, are we going to potentially see along those lines the resurgence of licensed games, because it's going to be so much easier to pull some of those assets in depending on the production of the film as well?
It's really, that was probably for me, the dynamic lighting and the virtualized geometry through nanites and lumens was probably the most interesting thing, technically speaking, about the demo. I was floored. Like, this is going to open up so many more avenues for developers to do cool things, to bring in beautiful textures and beautiful backgrounds. And I'm so excited about what the future of graphics are for video games that I was kind of not paying attention to the rest of it until you brought until you brought it to me after we were done watching. You're like, oh, did you notice this, this, and this? Oh, no, it was too pretty. I'm sorry, I was blinded.
The one thing that I'm really interested about is if this will have a similar effect to NVIDIA's DLSS. Now, for those of you who aren't familiar, on the 20 series cards, I just upgraded to a 2070 Super. My older card wasn't keeping up anymore. And I wanted to play Control. And the Northlight engine is a beast. And it just wasn't working terribly well on my card. So I upgraded and it gave me access to ray tracing, but it also gave me access to this DLSS, which essentially is AI-based upscaling. So I could play the game at a lower render, but then use DLSS to bring it up to a 1440p. resolution. And there is, and they just released DLSS 2.0, and I know that Control is one of the first games that's using it. I think Minecraft might be using it as well with the ray tracing.
Yeah, I think so too.
And they have actually, so there was some, if, there was some side-by-sides, and I love this about NVIDIA, like whenever they do stuff, they actually, they do side-by-sides. Here's what it looks like, you know, running it native, like 1080 versus DLSS with 1080, or native 1440, and then DLSS 1440. So that you can see like, okay, yeah, there's some artifacting going on, and there's some stuff where there are some places where it doesn't work quite well. Well, 2.0 is even better. And I'm curious if this is going to ultimately reduce the load for PC games. And we know it's going to have a console effect, and we'll talk about that in a second. But I'm wondering if this is going to have an effect such that it spreads out the amount of upgrading that people need to do, that we're going to be able to allow the software to fill in the blanks a little bit and provide a better resolution at a lower hardware spec. So I'm really interested to see what this does. But I do specifically want to talk about the fact that there was this strange marriage in this press con, or in this hour-long interview tech demo about Unreal Engine 5.
Okay, so one of the things that Mike and I talked about yesterday was it was a really strange presentation for a consumer audience. It felt very similar to Sony's presentation about, you know, the PlayStation 5's architecture with Mark Cerny. As much as we love Mark Cerny ASMR for nerds, because it was great, it was absolutely the same kind of feeling where it's like, okay, this is really cool and I'm really glad to be nerding out about the PlayStation 5 and I'm really glad to be nerding out about UE5, but where's the hook for consumers here?
Mm-hmm. And the hook for the consumers was, ooh, how pretty. But then there was this other thing, and my understanding is that the chat got a little toxic.
Yeah. Yeah, it wasn't...
Because we watched on our big screen TV. We watched on the 4K.
We did.
Via YouTube. So there was no chat on our screen, which for us, that's like heaven.
Yeah, there was a lot of hubbub around Reddit, around Twitter, and on YouTube about, you know, like, where's the games? Why are we not talking about the games? You know, where are the things that are supposed to hook us as gamers, as fans?
And here was the thing that the gamers latched onto. Tim Sweeney talked a lot about the PlayStation 5.
Yes.
And did not mention, I mean, he did say that, look, Unreal Engine 5 is designed to work across platforms. Tim Sweeney and Epic are very committed to open systems and not having walled gardens. But at the same time, he really hit heavy on the PlayStation 5. And that caused, as you might expect, because it's at that time of cycle, a lot of console warriors coming out to play.
I don't, you know what? After all these years, I have never understood the need to be a console warrior. It, even when I was younger, even when I could only afford to have like my N64, like that was my console. I wasn't able to have a PlayStation, but I just went to my buddy's house that had a PlayStation so that I could go play PlayStation games. I didn't care what I played it on. I just wanted to play video games.
And I grew up as a Nintendo kid, and my good friend down the street, they were a Sega household. So it was like the best of both worlds. But just very quickly, the idea behind console wars and the reason why you see them peter out later on in a generation is that at the beginning, and it's going to be even worse this cycle because you're going to have supply that's so heavily constrained.
And it's not even just about the supply, as we have said over and over and over again, gaming is a luxury.
It is.
Gaming is not something that you can put money into if you do not have money that is liquid.
Absolutely. If you don't have the discretionary disposable income, it's really tough. And we expect that these consoles are probably going to be coming in for $5,500. Just because they're more cutting edge technology, and both of them have solid state drives, and that drives the price up. But we know that component cost is going up. We know that manufacturing cost
is going up. Thinking that it's going to be like $550?
No, $450 to $500.
Okay. What you said was $5,500, and I'm like, oh.
Oh yeah. It's just like it's like a Super Neo Geo.
Wow.
Yeah.
Okay, so not $5,500.
No, $450 to $500 is where I expect the pricing.
And that does make sense. And remember, that's also just in the United States. We are not talking about the exchange rates that are going to have to be taken into account for outside of the United States. Like, Canada's going to get hit hard because our dollar's no good.
So, real quickly, and then we'll kind of bounce back to the UE5 angle here. You know, you have people who likely cannot afford both consoles at launch. Yep. If they can, you know, there's a lot of games at launch that people want to play. It's very expensive at the beginning of a cycle.
Of course.
And there are people, not everyone, of course, but there are people who make their decision and then feel like they have to
justify
it. Yeah. Their decision. There's this confirmation bias. There's this constant fear that, oh no, what if I bought the wrong one and now I can't buy the other console until much later?
So how this feeds into this conversation about Unreal Engine was that they were so heavily focused on, hey, this tech demo is actually running on not PC,
yep,
but PlayStation 5.
Which is exceptionally impressive. Now, that wasn't just the, hey, by the way, we're running on PlayStation 5. This was a big part of the conversation.
It was.
Now, GameSpeed talked to Tim Sweeney, who told them that Epic has been working with Sony on the PS5, specifically around, quote, storage architecture and other elements. We also know from Mark Cerny's presentation, ASMR for nerds.
I should go back and watch it again.
It's so good. It'll help. It'll just put us at ease. Sony's using some proprietary storage solutions for its solid state drive. It uses a custom 12-channel memory controller. So this could be one of the big gaps between the PlayStation 5 and the Xbox Series X, where, look, both consoles are going to have solid state drives. We know that it's going to be, you know, in terms of what we've experienced, in terms of load times, in terms of, you know, pop-in, you know, which has certainly got better this generation, part of that being the move from UE3 to UE4. UE3 yeah. was notorious for its pop-in. You know, you load in a new area and it takes about 4 seconds before all the textures fully populate. So the technology itself, the engine itself, is going to be a big leap forward. We know the hardware, the specs, and the components on the PlayStation 5 and the Xbox Series X are going to move, you know, that aspect of development forward. I think it is far too early to say that what we saw in that tech demo yesterday could only be done on a PlayStation 5. And I feel like that's where some of the console warrior nonsense was happening. So I'm eager to see and hear about how UE5 runs on an Xbox Series X. I'm certainly interested to see what it's going to do on a PC and if that's going to alleviate some of the load on a GPU. But regardless, I think from a visual perspective, it's exciting, but that's not the only part that matters.
The other portion of this that's important to remember is that with new consoles and with taking a leap forward in technology, there's always that steep learning curve, right? Or there's usually that steep learning curve for developers. It's buying all the new tools and having to deal with, oh my goodness, this is completely different than the platform that I'm used to. And oh my goodness, I have to spend all this time learning this and then building on this. And then, oh my goodness, I did it wrong. And there's a lot of questions there. But for this generation, what I've been noticing, Sony and Microsoft, that they're looking to ease the development learning curve. Mm-hmm. And UE5 is likely also moving down this path with its tools. But there's also, like, they're also making things easier on developers in terms of waiving royalty fees as well. Mm-hmm. That's a really big one. So Epic is now going to be waiving royalty fees up to the first $1 million US in gross revenue, which is retroactive to the beginning of 2020.
So if you're operating under an Unreal Engine agreement now, and you had been thinking like, oh, you reached that $3,000 per quarter, which is where the threshold used to be before you started paying Epic the 5% Unreal Engine licensing fee.
Yeah.
All of a sudden, if you haven't made your first $1 million yet, but you had hit that earlier threshold, suddenly you've got cash in your pocket because you're not going to be paying Epic up until you reach that first $1 million.
That's fully in line with how Sweeney has been helping to move Unreal more towards this egalitarian approach of, listen, game development, everybody should be making games. Mm-hmm. And we want to make making games as easy as possible. And if you are making games as a professional, we don't want to punish you for being an indie.
Yeah, it's amazing. It's great. Additionally, you know, Epic has been, they've been purchasing up a couple of middleware companies. We see some of that stuff baked into UE5. But as part of Epic's own work, you know, Fortnite was a big factor in making cross-platform play, especially across consoles. I mean, something we only dreamed about when we were kids. You know, that's a reality now for a lot of games. So Epic did all that work. They built all that infrastructure. They built all that architecture. And they're giving it away for free now. So if you've got a game on PlayStation, Xbox, Switch, PC, Mac, you can use their SDK and that the stuff that enables Fortnite's crossplay. You can, so it's lobbies, matchmaking, peer-to-peer networking solutions, achievements, stats, leaderboards, importantly, analytics.
Analytics is an enormous part of running a live ops game, especially because if you don't know what your players are doing, when they're doing it, and how long they're doing it, how are you supposed to make data-driven decisions?
Exactly. And one of the things that Epic is touting is that we know, based on some recent reports, and they reiterated this in their press release, there are 350 million Epic account holders. Each of those Fortnite players out there, there are 350 million Fortnite players. Each of them has an Epic account. We know that, by the way, Fortnite is going to be a launch title on Xbox Series X and PlayStation 5, and it's going to be transitioned to UE5 at some point. There are 500 million devices that Epic accounts are active on, 7 different platforms, and amongst those, there are 2.2 billion friend connections. So every user has, you know, not every user, but a lot of users have friends on the platform through their matchmaking and friend service. There are 2.2 million of those connections.
Billion
of those connections, excuse me.
That's bananas.
Yeah. There is one thing that I want to touch on, and this kind of popped up later because I just saw the headline this morning. There was a headline from an outlet that I'm not going to name because I'm not trying to call anybody out here, but the headline was something along the lines like of what we saw in the UE5 demo isn't really going to push games forward. And I think that this is where I think it was a mistake for this format. And this is something we touched on a little bit. This was not a consumer focused presentation. This was a GDC presentation.
It really was.
And you're going to lose people. You're going to have people with the wrong takeaways from this. No, that tech demo, what we saw wasn't about innovative gameplay. That's up to designers and developers what they do with the tools. This was to show off visually and technologically what is possible with the tools.
What it's capable of when you're using this engine.
So if you came away from that saying, UE5 isn't going to give, you know, what I saw yesterday isn't really innovative gameplay. Well, no, it's not supposed to be. It's not in the hands of the developers who are going to be doing innovative things with it. It's important to remember that that was one visual style, and yes, that was photorealistic, it was gorgeous, but not every Unreal Engine 3 game or Unreal Engine 4 game leaned on photorealism. There's the artistic style. Every game is going to have its own artistic style. So yes, we're going to get some photorealistic stuff, but just like we didn't get games that looked like that Infiltrator demo for UE4 until, I'd argue, very recently with the Final Fantasy VII Remake, which was made on Unreal Engine 4. Mm-hmm. Don't expect that the first Unreal Engine 5 games are going to look like that. They might not look photorealistic at all.
And that could very much so be on purpose. Mm-hmm. Not everybody wants photorealism. Photorealism. You know what? I'm going to lean into that.
Photo Royale,
because I was thinking about
100 people drop onto an island to take pictures.
That sounds amazing. Can we do that?
Pokemon Snap meets Battle Royale.
I'm into it. I want a Pokemon Snap Royale. That sounds great. Anyway, not everybody wants a photorealistic game experience. Some of us want like cartoony and cute, and some of us want like highly stylized, dripping in gore. All of these things are possible. Mm-hmm. It doesn't all have to be photorealism, 8K with the 8K realistic textures. You can do this with whatever assets you want. The point is that Epic is making it easier and less intrusive for developers to create games using their engine.
Yeah. And I'm sure that as games start rolling out with UE5, there will be tons of blog posts available and tons of Gamma Sutra stories about how the new tech is powering games in ways that end users might not understand, but are very relevant to the development community. So I was really excited by what I saw from the UE5 demo yesterday. I don't think it was the right setting. I don't think it was targeted at the right audience. I think that leaning so heavily on the PlayStation 5 aspect of things might have, again, because of the audience and the setting, not that Jeff did a poor job. I thought Jeff's interview was great.
Everybody that was on that call, everyone at Epic did a great job. They were interesting to listen to. I learned a ton. So,
yeah,
I thought it was great. It just wasn't for a consumer-facing audience. Yeah. That's the biggest issue that happened yesterday.
And I think we're seeing some of that in the capital D discourse that came out of that. So just, again, I would have loved to have seen that, you know, filtered through, the normal GDC information propagation system that exists, because it ended up, you know, getting distracted by a couple of things. One was the console wars, and two, people digging on people's home offices. Like,
it's not it's not cool.
Yeah. It's not cool. Especially professionals doing it. I was too focused on how cool the tech seemed to be.
I just want to talk about dynamic lighting forever.
Oh my gosh, Dan, the dynamic lighting is awesome.
All right, so the next piece of news that we have to talk about today is about a brand new development studio.
Yes.
So there are two vets from Respawn,
yes,
of all places, have mm-hmm. formed a remote studio. So a studio that is going to be functioning as fully decentralized. Mm-hmm. There are going to be people everywhere doing whatever it is that they're going to be doing. Man, that cuts down on overhead. Mm-hmm. This new studio is called Gravity Well. It's been founded by John Shearing and Drew McCoy. What's the significance of John and Drew being the two founding members of Gravity Well?
So John Shearing and Drew McCoy were with Respawn from the beginning. They were at Infinity Ward with Vince Zampella and Jason West when that whole thing happened and there was the big lawsuit.
That was rough.
So John and Drew were involved with Titanfall, Titanfall 2, Apex Legends, and both of them had key roles. John Shearing was the lead programmer on Apex Legends. Drew McCoy was the executive producer on Apex Legends. They were well known and were a big piece of the core of that studio. And one of the things that was really interesting when they announced that they were forming their own studio was that there was this commitment to healthy game development and making sure that, you know, the creative is up front and that people have, I think they were really focused on getting away from some of the more problematic aspects of game development that we've talked about. We've talked about crunch. We've talked about, studio structures that don't necessarily work.
But the big piece of this is, the big piece of it for a lot of these studios is that they get too big. Mm-hmm. They get really bloated and there are lots of people doing lots of different things. So what John Shearing had said is that they are going to be capping their studio at 85 people, at just under 100 people. And this is what he had to say. This is what John Shearing had to say. So, quote, "Once your team size crosses 100 people, everything changes. You need meetings just to make decisions, choices get siloed, and brilliant creatives become less creative." Mm-hmm. You get lost in the red tape, and you get lost in having to make decisions with a bunch of different people as opposed to just a small handful of people. It's not to say that there isn't going to be, you know, okay, we got to slow down. We have to make data-driven decisions about creative choices and putting creative boundaries in place. It's mm-hmm. not about that. It's about ensuring that people are doing their best work and not being hampered by too much minutia.
Yep. So we've got a studio that is committed to no crunch, that while, you know, COVID-19 has been a part of their inspiration to be a remote studio, whether that ends up being, you know, once things return, you know, move to the new normal, whether that's entirely remote or just fostering a very remote friendly culture, you know, they are allowing people to work in the ways that that empower them.
What comes to mind here is the way that Wolfi Studios is actually, you know, they're technically based in Austin. That's like a hard technical, and that's just because of where their founder is located. His name is escaping me. Raph.
Oh, yeah.
Raph from, he was the founder at Arcane. So when Raph ended up forming this company, it was around the same tenets of like, why would we be in an office? Why would we have to filter out people based on where they live? We want to work with the best people from around the world. We don't want to be bogged down mm-hmm. by having a central place where everybody has to congregate. Why wouldn't we be fully virtual?
Sure.
I feel like Gravity Well is moving in that same avenue. Why do we need to have an office to have these creative decisions when we could just be planning, you know, parties and meeting up at events, or mm-hmm. we could be planning for retreats instead where we all meet up somewhere that's relatively centralized.
Now, real quickly before we move on, Wolfi is working on Weird West, correct?
Yes. Wolfi, That looks real cool.
Yeah, it looks super cool.
It looks real cool. I'm pretty psyched about everything that Wolfeye is doing, and I love everything that they stand for. So that's really what it reminded me of, is that Gravity Well is
it's a good comparison.
Yeah. So that's what that was. But there's more to it. You know, what else did they have to say?
You know, I think that there is a real commitment here from John and Drew that they want this studio to exist for a while. They want, they really
are forward looking.
Yeah, it's very forward looking. And again, we come back to the no crunch, focusing on the health of the studio, making sure that the creative, that people are empowered to be creative. But here's what Drew McCoy had to say, quote, "We're starting a studio because of how we want to make games. We want time to iterate on everything and get ideas and feedback from the whole team." Again, they're keeping that team small, capping it at 85. "We're building this studio to last for decades, and that doesn't happen without putting the team first."
It's culture oriented. It is. And that's the thing that a lot of these larger studios have tended to have fallen down with, is that because they didn't bake this into their culture to begin with, it ends up in this place where they're not able to make nimble decisions.
All right. So I'm really excited to see what they come up with. I'm a huge fan of the work that they did when they were at Respawn, and very excited to find out what Gravity Well comes up with. We have some financials to talk about. We've got
a lot of financials to talk about.
We do. So
but we'll go through them quickly.
Yeah, let's go through them quickly. Actually, this the note that started this in our show notes is that Sony's finally, you know, doing something to unify its studios.
Yeah, because I always forget which studios they own.
Mm-hmm. And which they just have very strong relationships with.
Which, up until Insomniac was purchased by Sony, it was just like they have a really good relationship with Insomniac. But now Insomniac belongs to Sony, but there's no way for us to know that they belong to Sony because it's not under one umbrella. Until now.
Until now. So, PlayStation Studios, which reminds us a lot of how the intro is very Marvel-esque. Microsoft Game Studios.
There we go.
Has organized themselves where they have all these unique teams, but they are pulled together under brand, and that's the way it's been for a long time. Or it's Xbox Game Studios.
It
now,
was
right?
yes,
it was Microsoft Studios before, and it's Xbox Game Studios.
I
now.
Believe that's the case. Yeah, but it's been like that since the beginning.
Oh,
like,
yeah.
They've always done that, and that's very much so a Microsoft way of handling things. Microsoft owns many companies, and everything comes under the Microsoft umbrella at the end of the day. That's just the way that the company has been culturally oriented over its many years of operation. So it's really interesting to see that PlayStation, even though it is going through its own internal turmoil and has been going through its own internal turmoil for a little while, it's nice to see that they're pulling together this holistic brand under PlayStation Studios.
Indeed. And, you know, just as a quick reminder of, you know, what those studios are and how many studios Sony owns, obviously Sony Santa Monica responsible for God of War, Guerrilla responsible for Horizon Zero Dawn, Insomniac, Spider-Man.
Spidey.
You know, obviously they've done a number of other things in there as well, but Spider-Man being the most recent, Sucker Punch.
Mm-hmm.
We've got Media Molecule, so Dreams.
Which is Dreams
Naughty
and
Dog.
Little Big Planet.
Yeah, and Naughty Dog.
Oh,
which
yes.
Which is Last of Us.
Yeah.
And Uncharted. Polyphony.
What does Polyphony do?
That's Gran Turismo.
Oh, no wonder I love Polyphony.
Yes.
I love me some Gran Turismo. I forgot that was their job.
And then you've got their studios in Bend, Oregon, London, Japan, San Diego, San Mateo. So they have a lot of studios.
Yeah. They have quite a few studios, like just as many as Microsoft has.
Yes. And so the branding, which was announced, you'll start seeing it on games along with the PlayStation 5 launch. So The Last of Us 2 won't have it. Horizon Zero Dawn on PC when that launches in a little bit, that won't have it. And Ghost of Tsushima will not have it as well. And I assume that also means, well, I guess Iron Man VR is not being developed by an internal studio.
No,
so that
that's being contracted out.
So, well, you'll start seeing that around when the PlayStation 5 launches. So as I accidentally mentioned earlier, it has this very Marvel feel at the beginning of it. They've also designed it so that it can be interchangeable, so that they can add and change characters, because at the beginning it has Kratos, it's got Aloy, I think Ellie's in there as well. So expect to see that, and expect to see that branding on games made by their internal studios. I think it's a good move. I think it's long overdue. I think it creates some more cohesion around Sony's own studios.
And we no longer have to scratch our heads and be like, okay, which studios does Sony own? Oh, I forget.
Yeah, right?
It's just easier to keep track of it.
So along with that, we do know that Sony has once again reaffirmed that we'll see the PlayStation 5 holiday 2020. Again, we don't know what supply is going to look like. The crisis is so unpredictable right now. We don't know.
I'm not even sure Sony or Microsoft now.
No, and I think that they are continuing to reaffirm their plans is the right call. We know that what they say publicly is the tip of the iceberg with regards to communication, that it's not until we get closer that we'll have an understanding of the impact that COVID's going to have on manufacturing and distribution. And also announced that they have sold 110.4 million PlayStation 4s.
That's really impressive.
It's exceptionally impressive. The PlayStation 2 is the last of their consoles to reach 100 million. PS4 clearly dominated this generation. Microsoft, I think, made some great strides coming back, especially after Phil Spencer, you know, became established as the head of Xbox. And there was some iterative design. I love my Xbox One X. I don't love the operating system, but the hardware itself I think is fantastic. And then there's all the services that back that up. Game Pass. Right.
And also xCloud, but also Game Pass.
Yes. So back to Sony. Just some quick notes that we pulled away. Game and network services. So remember, Sony's a huge company. They have music. They've got film. They've got superconductors. There's a lot that Sony does.
They have a lot of technology.
Indeed. So the PlayStation 4 operation is grouped under game and network services. The sales of that dropped $3.1 billion. Operating income dropped $680 million. And the reason Sony said it was down was PS4 hardware sales are down. That's to be expected at the end of a console generation.
Yeah, people are not going to be buying new mm-hmm. PlayStations or new consoles or whatever at the end of a console life cycle, knowing full well that they have some difficult decisions to make with their disposable income going forward.
Absolutely. They noted that software sales are down as well.
Everybody's playing free-to-play. Everybody's getting in on a lot of those live op games, which you can play on any platform for the mm-hmm. most part.
Yep. And foreign exchange rates actually negatively affected them. Well, you know, we see this. This is something that it goes up and down. FX is one of those things that's kind of a wild card. But PlayStation Plus was up, of course.
Yeah, of course, right? It was up.
And PlayStation, you know, so PlayStation Plus was up. They've got more people subscribing. Now is the right time. People are playing online. What they said, they had some impacts from the COVID-19 crisis. Mm-hmm. They actually saw an increase of $26 million for game software downloads and network services. So that just essentially means the results were better than anticipated. They expected there to be a fall off.
Yeah.
So they had an expectation. They did a little bit better than their expectation. Things still went down, just not quite as much. Again, PlayStation 4 hardware is trending well. Same deal, right? People are buying consoles. If you only had an Xbox One, for instance, going into this crisis, maybe you're like, hey, now's a good time to buy a PS4.
Well, it's on sale.
Right.
Like, there are bundles, there are sales, they have a robust library. Like, arguably the better library.
If you're not a hardcore gamer, if you're not a core player, if you're someone who, you know, kind of moves in and out of the hobby, right? This is not a bad time to be buying a console. It's like, oh man, I missed this entire generation. Look at this feast of games. There's a Spider-Man game. There's a new God of War.
Yeah, it's definitely, if you're gonna buy a PlayStation 4, now would be the time. If you're not a core gamer. If you are a core gamer and you don't have a PlayStation, it's likely on purpose.
Right. And, you know, if you're a core gamer, if you're someone who is like, oh, I didn't have a whole lot of money, but I've, you know, suddenly have a better job and I've got more stability in my life, I really get back into gaming, I'd say wait a few months, get a PS5, because our understanding is that most of the PlayStation 4 library is going to be playable on the PS5. Again, different recommendations for different folks, depends on your situation. Always glad to offer if you have any, if you're coming back into the hobby, if you're new to the hobby, please let us know. We'd love to talk to you. We're glad to give our thoughts. The other thing that Sony mentioned is that they are seeing no major issues in development at this point due to COVID-19. Kind of goes back to the whole indefinite delay of The Last of Us Part 2 and Iron Man VR, that those were related to manufacturing and distribution more so than development.
So the indefinite delays that were definitely not indefinite delays, they were just definite delays for the right now?
Yes. So again, we know that...
definitive delays for now.
Yeah. So Last of Us Part 2 is coming at the end of June. And then we have Iron Man VR, which is now slated. It does have a new release date of July 3rd.
Yeah.
And that about covers Sony. Anything that you, any other thoughts that you have on Sony before we jump ahead?
No, I think we covered everything. Let's go ahead and jump into Square Enix. They ended up reporting their fiscal year for 2020, I guess. Did they seriously close out 2020 already?
Yeah, it was March 31st. They have the March 31st.
I guess that's true. It's just bananas. I don't know. I've been doing this for so many years, and you'd think that I'd be used to it by now, and I'm just never used to it. I'm like, guys, we're in the middle of 2020. Why are we reporting on 2020? But no, that's just the way my brain works. So just as, you know, I sat down last night when Mike and I were talking about this before we sat down to record. And he was like, all right, so got to look at Square Enix financials. I'm like, oh, yeah? Yeah? Pretty sure they're down everywhere except for Final Fantasy. And I was pretty right. They are, in fact, down 10.1% on sales overall. Digital entertainment is down 15%. But publication is up 5.2%?
Mm-hmm.
That's really interesting. No, so
publication isn't game publication.
That's right. So the publication is around their mangas, their ebooks, their printed media, and everything like that. So that is up. I mean, that's also not surprising given where they are with a lot of their lore within the vast majority of their games. Mm-hmm. I mean, Final Fantasy 14 especially, oh my goodness.
Mm-hmm.
So very much going on in there. So their HD games, their net sales were down year over year. It's not a bad thing, though, that it was specifically this quarter.
Right. It's important. And this is why when we talk about looking at financials, everything is contextualized.
Absolutely. So the reason why this particular quarter wasn't as strong, or this particular year wasn't as strong, is because they had a number of major releases in fiscal year 2019.
Mm-hmm.
So what ended up happening is, like, look, they didn't have anything huge that came out during this fiscal year. So, of course, it's not going to be necessarily as strong. What remains strong, though, is their net sales, their operating income for Final Fantasy XIV, as well as for Dragon Quest X, because Dragon Quest X has expansion packs, and they also have a subscriber program? Or is it just expansion packs?
For Dragon Quest X. That's an online game. So Dragon Quest X isn't out here in the West. Oh, it's an MMO.
So that's their MMO. You know what? I stopped paying attention to Dragon Quest after they released Dragon Quest Builders 2, because Builders is the only thing I really care about.
Yeah, so 9 was released here.
Right, I remember that. And that was the single player game. That was the remaster collector's game of the year question mark.
Wait, are you thinking of Dragon Quest XI, the one that was just released?
Maybe.
Okay. So Dragon Quest XI was the one that was just released on Switch. Dragon Quest IX was Sentinels of the Starry Skies. It was released DS.
That really?
Yeah.
Dip. Yeah. Okay, so Dragon Quest X, which is not available in the West, and that's why I thought it looked kind of weird. And Final Fantasy XIV, their two MMOs and their two very successful franchises are doing pretty good.
Yeah. This is the time.
This is the time. And let me tell you, as a fairly staunch MMO and now Final Fantasy XIV fan, can we just, like, knock off early and go play Heavensward?
We are so close. Well, we're so close to the end of 2.0, and my understanding is there's story between 2.0 and 2.5 that we've got to wrap before we can get to Heaven's
Word. We got another 10 to 15 hours.
That's a different podcast.
Boo! Okay, anyway, not actually boo. So, what else is going on with Square Enix? I know Final Fantasy 14 looks good, Dragon Quest 10 looks good. What else are they doing? They've got
their mobile games. They got a ton of mobile games.
Oh my god, they have so many.
So they called out Romancing Saga Reuniverse and Dragon Quest Walk, which is their Pokemon Go alike.
That's right. That Dragon Quest Walk game looked really weird.
Yeah. So Square Enix is big on the mobiles, big on the PC browser games, not here, but
big on the gotchas.
Big on the gotchas. So those are doing well. Again, no big surprise. They had solid arcade operations, but they anticipate that that's going to take a hit. Obviously, people
that's are gonna not going to arcades right now. That's going to take a total nosedive, especially considering that the vast majority of their arcade games are going to be in Japan.
Yes. Their publication division, as you mentioned, which is digital sales, their manga up, and their ebooks, those were up sharply. And their sales of printed media also were brisk, resulting in year-over-year growth in net sales and operating income.
Merch was up.
Merch was up.
Merch was up. Did you see that merch line when we were at PAX East? That was bananas. I really wanted to get in there to go get some merch for myself for, like, I don't know, Final Fantasy.
I wouldn't mind those polygon-style Final Fantasy VII characters. Like,
they're really cute.
They are really cute. Like, they're super like Chonky cute. Cloud and Chonky Tifa and Chonky Aerith and Chonky Roth.
Chonky Roth.
Chunky Roth.
Okay, so merch sales are up year over year. And that's because of releasing new merchandise on key IPs. So that is definitely Final Fantasy VII, especially.
Yeah. And then the last thing that they confirmed is that while some publishers will be doing their own big E3 replacement digital showcase, Square Enix will not. They will be announcing new games
Game by game. And they will likely be announcing them. Like, just remember that Square Enix only just started doing their own showcases over the last couple of years. Yep. This is relatively new. We were in the audience last year.
Yeah, they've done two or three of them. I think the very first one was 2013 or 2014. I was with Game Informer.
But then they took a break from doing
them. They did, because there wasn't a whole lot. And then they came back strong with Avengers and...
And that was 2018?
No, Avengers took a couple years off. There was like the Avengers teaser, but the last year was like big on Final Fantasy VII Remake and Avengers, and there was a lot.
There was a lot last year, just in general. They had a lot going on. So it's not surprising to me that they're going to take the year to be like, all right, why would we put additional expense into this? We're already dealing with our own trailers anyway, so may as well get in on what Sony and Microsoft, and Nintendo eventually are going to be showcasing. So. Oh my goodness, can we please talk about Paradox?
Let's talk about Paradox.
I love talking about Paradox. Paradox and just makes me so happy. I love their games. I am an unmitigated hype monster about so many of their products, including Bloodlines 2, y'all. Bloodlines 2!
I mean, I'm not going to lie to you, and if any of my friends at Paradox are listening to this, we've been playing a lot of strategy lately. We've been playing a lot of Civ lately, and I have had the strong itch to return to Stellaris. And
Stellaris makes me feel like a dumbhead, even though I'm very good at 4X games.
Okay, so here's the thing that always sticks out to me about Stellaris. It's like you meet a new race, and it's like you don't speak the same language. You have to go through this whole process of like.
It's a very granular game. Anyway, we're not here to talk about games, Mike.
I know.
We're here to talk about the business of games.
Yes.
For the rest of us. Okay, so let's talk about some financials. So Paradox's earnings came in yesterday, I believe. And Stellaris has sold 3 million copies.
Yes.
Holy crap. For a strategy game?
Yeah.
That's enormous.
And it's on console.
Yes.
It's on console. So it's
very difficult on console, but yes.
I have not played it on console.
I have it on PlayStation.
Oh, okay. And they just announced like there's going to be a second like season pass. So the way they've done these season passes is I think the first one has like one major expansion and a couple of the races. And I think the next one's going to have... Because there are... I went and I looked. There are four big expansions for Stellaris.
Stellaris has been out for what? Like 4 years this year?
Is it that long?
I think so. It either came out in 2016 or 2017, but I'm pretty sure that it came out around that time.
That sounds right.
So Paradox didn't release any new games this quarter.
Mm-hmm.
But that doesn't matter because they shipped major expansions for Stellaris, Hearts of Iron 4, and Cities Skylines. This is the fascinating thing about Paradox. Paradox is huge on, like, if they have an established IP and it is doing well, they will support it possibly until the end of time.
Yep.
Because Cities Skylines came out in, what, 2015, I believe?
I think you're right about that. That sounds about right. It might have been 2014. So here's the thing. It came out after SimCity, and everybody was like...
It was so much better than SimCity.
And everybody's like, oh, wow, this is what we wanted. SimCity to be. So Cities Skylines came out in 2015, March 10, 2015.
So there we go. Almost
exactly 5 years ago.
All right, cool. So anyway, they have a bunch of these amazing games and IPs that are like intensely loved by their communities, and they support them and support them and support them. And they do paid DLC. Mm-hmm. They do...
There's free DLC.
Like the free updates that they do. Which is fantastic.
So just... A lot of their games, like Paradox was known for a long time as the grand strategy company. So Europa Universalis and Crusader Kings and, you know, Stellaris took that concept into space. But Hearts of Iron is a World War II strategy game where you're focused on mechanized units, so tanks. You know, Cities Skylines is grand strategy, but it's a city builder like SimCity. Obviously, they've cast a wider net lately. Battletech is not grand strategy, it's turn-based strategy, but it's still strategy. You know, Knights of Pen and Paper is great. Prison Architect, also strategy, but again, not quite. So we see them slowly casting a wider net. Obviously, their acquisition of White Wolf.
This is the biggie.
Yeah.
The big one for them that moves outside of the regular realm of being known for strategy is their acquisition of White Wolf. Mm-hmm. So they are not just focusing on the video game portion of White Wolf. You know, they also helped to release an updated version of the 5th edition of Vampire the Masquerade, which I have sitting upstairs and I love very much and I like to just stare at. and they're also working on the much anticipated sequel to Vampire the Masquerade Bloodlines, which was a beloved cult hit by folks like me that love vampire, but we only have really had like two decent vampire games in the... oh my goodness, like almost 30 years that Vampyr has been around. Like, it's been around for a really long time. So clearly what Paradox is doing, and they also Empire of Sin. Empire of Sin is the other really big one. And that is also a strategy game of sorts.
It is. And it's kind of along the lines of, you know, think about Age of Wonders, Planetfall, right? Which is...
Another really good one. That's right. Like, Planetfall is such a great game.
And Planetfall, if you've not played it, if you're a fan of Civ, and you're a fan of XCOM-style strategy, Planetfall is the game for you because you have these grander civilization management aspects to it. But when you get into a battle, obviously you can auto-complete the battle if that's not your thing. But it goes into a, oh, you've got your army and you've got these enemy units and surprise, you're playing XCOM suddenly.
So many good games from Paradox.
Yes.
So because Paradox has so many good games and they have games that are continually enjoyable for long periods of time, they play the long tail.
They do.
At Paradox. So they have had a 68% increase in revenue year over year. Operating profit is up 164% and profit before tax is up 50% year over year.
With no new games released in the quarter. So this is all on expansions. This is all on
new
fostering
players.
New players, fostering that community. Stellaris is having a free weekend this weekend. Its expansions are on sale. I'm in trouble because my wallet is like creaking open. I was actually just having a conversation with Mike Laidlaw on Twitter about Stellaris and which expansions to go with. Now, what I've been told, again, I know this isn't a games podcast per se.
Yeah, Mike, geez, we don't talk about video games.
But this is going to segue into our next point. So, you know, if you are a Civ player,
yes,
you typically know that, yes, Civ is okay to play at vanilla.
Yes.
It's better to play after the first expansion. And once that second expansion is complete, it's a fully realized vision of what that game was intended to be, even if some of those decisions were made after vanilla launched, right?
Sure.
Stellaris has kind of a mix of your traditional DLC model and that Civ thing where there are some expansions, this is according to Mike Laidlaw, that where some of those expansions are kind of integral to the experience and really fix or improve some core mechanics, and others, as he put it, help you live out different sci-fi fantasies. So it's not like you need to go all in and buy all these expansions all at once when you're starting up. However, if you look at Hearts of Iron 4, if you look at Stellaris, if you look at Cities Skylines, and you're looking to jump into one of those games, it can be really intimidating to look at what is over $100 of DLC. In fact, most of it's on sale right now, except for the most recent expansion for Stellaris. And if you knock off the one that's not on sale, so let's the new one, if you would just want to play everything up to or buy everything up to the most recent expansion, it's like $75.
That's a fairly significant
amount of money. I think there's a bundle, though, that because, you know, bundling on Steam is actually really smart. It actually might knock it down further. But there's a lot of DLC for each of these games, and that's just one. And then you look at all these others. So what I wanted to talk to you about, and we had a little bit of this conversation before we started recording, is, you know, is Paradox positioned well for a subscription model, either for its entire catalog, where it's like you love grand strategy, come and play all of our games plus subscription, or on a game-by-game basis, or not at all?
So, okay, well, that's the really interesting thing, is that let's look at the numbers. The numbers are telling us that they don't need it.
Correct.
They do not need a subscription model to be successful with any of their games. Their games are beloved, and strategy players are, like, they are fervent. They have their game or their couple of games that they adore, and they will put all of their money into it. And that is what they, it's like an MMO, right?
Mm-hmm.
So you get really invested in this particular kind of strategy game. Like for me, it's Civ 6. And previously to that, it was the 500 hours I put into Civ 5.
You got a problem. But it's a good problem.
It's a really good problem to have. I now stream Civ 6. On a regular basis, mm-hmm. Hashtag Ready Player Mom.
And we have a multiplayer game going here in the house that we're almost done with. And, you know, so Civ is a perfect game for our current situation.
It definitely is. So anyway, the point that I'm trying to make is they are positioned well for a subscription model, both within their catalog and within their specific games, but they absolutely do not need it.
Yeah.
And I don't think that their players are necessarily calling for it. It would potentially end up alienating the players that have been there the longest, because mm-hmm. they are the ones that have fronted that cost and continuing to fuel development costs, right? These are the folks that are invested in the growth of Stellaris, where they're in the Discord channel or they're emailing with the developers or they're in the community boards or whatever. I don't know what support looks like for Stellaris specifically, mm-hmm. but these are the folks that are so invested that if you turned it into a subscription model where you really watered it down to try to cast a broader net, I don't think that's what Paradox is all about. Paradox is about being laser focused on their community, and their community is laser focused on one or two Paradox games at a time.
And this is the thing, and I'm sure this is a conversation that Shams Drajani, who's the head of business development, and Daniel Goldberg, who's the head of marketing over Paradox, talk about on a regular basis. They have their own podcast, by the way, that's excellent.
Oh, that's true, yeah. That podcast rules.
So go ahead and listen to the Paradox podcast. In fact, I referenced it in one of the books. I can't remember if it was my first book or second book, because there was just some excellent conversation going on there. My question here is, in a situation like Paradox's, is if you have a diehard Europa Universalis player or mm-hmm. a diehard Hearts of Iron player,
mm-hmm.
and there are people who are like, I know I've spent $100+ on expansions for this one game. I'm not going to go get invested in another Paradox game because I know what it's going to be, and I know that I will want all that stuff. So my question is then, if you do a Game Pass-like model where it's like, hey, not only do you get access to all of our stuff so you can try our other games and see which ones you might like, because we know you love grand strategy, maybe you'd like it in another setting. If it also came with that Game Pass style discount, which is if you buy a game on Game Pass, a game that's on Game Pass, I think they knock off 20%.
I mean, that's true. I think that if they offered something like, hey, we're going to give you like 10 hours of free play playing Stellaris mm-hmm. or whatever, and we're going to give you a deep discount on purchasing Stellaris, both the base game and then any expansion packs, we're going to give you a bundle or whatever. Mm-hmm. We'll do a bundle deal. I think that could be really powerful, and there's a bigger incentive there, because yeah, it's like with any kind of strategy game, with any kind of grand strategy game, they are all so different from each other. They do not pull a lot of the same mechanics from each other. They're very different. Mm-hmm. So you kind of got to pick one and stay there.
Yeah.
It's like for me, you know, I'm not going to go from playing, I don't know, playing XCOM Chimera Squad, going into playing something like Total War Warhammer, where that is a significantly different game mm-hmm. than what I'm used to, or even going from a Total War game into playing Hearts of Iron. Mm-hmm. Like, these games are so vastly different from each other that it's difficult to be like, okay, well, I'm going to get really good at playing Hearts of Iron 4, and then I'm going to go move into Europa?
Yeah.
Or I'm going to go move into Stellaris? Like, I don't know. We'd have to, like, we would really have to, like, ask the players and be like, what are you guys looking for? Because for me, I don't think I would pay for something like yeah. that. It would be too intimidating. I'd have all these games and be like, I don't know if I can choose more strategy games. Yeah, I have so many.
Well, I mean, I guess what I want to say is, Shams, consider this an open invitation to come on the show anytime. We would love to have you. You know I love talking with you. So...
okay, yeah, we could sit here and talk about Paradox literally the whole
time. I love
time.
Paradox. I love their business model. I love how they have both embraced their roots as being the grand strategy publisher and have found very clever and smart ways to cast a wider net and bring more people into their community. So forever a fan of Paradox and the
Bloodlines,
work that...
Bloodlines. Bloodlines 2, put it in my veins.
Yes. Cool. So that about wraps up earnings. I want to talk about one more thing that popped back up only because...
Oh, this one's rough.
This one is rough. So Xavient, which was the developer on Lichdom Battle Mage...
Right.
...came out with a Battle Royale game that you may or may not remember because it predated PUBG. It predated Fortnite, obviously. It was called The Culling. Yes. And when it came out, like, it was neat. Because you come up in this elevator, it was very very Hunger Games style, and it was more melee-focused than a lot of the Battle Royales that are out there right now. And The Culling, it was interesting, it didn't do terribly well, and then it went away, and then they came out with The Culling 2, and it was not great, and it had a big problem, and they came back with an original version of The Culling to... So after The Culling 2 didn't do terribly well, they came back with the original version of The Culling, and now they've got yet another version of The Culling, the original. But now it's free to play, and now it's got this really strange business model that I think is going to end up tripping them and knocking them down the stairs.
So as it turns out, the way that this new Culling is, this new old Culling, this old new Culling... is set up is that players can play one free match online each day. One free match.
Now, there is an offline mode, apparently. So I guess you can practice.
Ugh.
But I don't know how much fun a Battle Royale-style game is going to be...
with bots?
If you're not... Yeah. I mean, it's... Again, if you only get one match a day online and you want to get good, I guess...
You're too old to say that.
I know I am.
So players can play additional matches, but there are a number of different hoops that they need to jump through. They either need to win an online match, which grants an online match token.
So if you win, you play again. That's great. Or you can buy online match tokens. So that's 3 tokens for 99 cents. Again, they're only 33 cents a pop.
But
10
still.
Tokens for $2.99, 20 tokens for $4.99. They're not really expensive. But here's my thing, and this is a question that I have. What happens if the server is DC?
Yeah.
And then do you lose your token? Like, how does that work?
So in addition to that, they are offering online play passes, providing unlimited online play, but these are purchased for 7 days for $2, mm-hmm. for $1.99, or 30 days, which is $5.99. I'm just like, it's such a confusing model. Like, why not just say...
It's a quarter muncher, right? It turns a home PC game into a quarter muncher. And I don't know. I feel like the closest thing that I can link it to is the old energy model style of games for free-to-play games, where it's like, you have to wait for your energy to recharge in order to play more Mafia Wars.
Well, and it's not even just Mafia Wars. We saw it with Jam City's latest Harry Potter game, where, you know, I was so, you remember, I was super excited when that came out. I'm a huge Harry Potter fan.
Now, this was not the Niantic one.
No. Oh my goodness, no. That the Niantic one is very focused around exploration and play and exercise. Mm-hmm. All the things that I talked to Niantic about during the GamesBeat Summit.
Yeah.
So, no, this is not the Niantic one. This is Jam City. Jam City is also known for working in conjunction with Disney for mm-hmm. Disney Bubble Pop, I think it's called.
Okay.
and for Cookie Jam, which is what I know Jam City for.
Got it.
So they also have, they had a license. I think they still have this license because the game still exists. I don't know how many changes they've made to it, but you get to a certain point in the game, and I don't want to spoil it for anybody in case you want to go and play it, just to see for yourself. You get to a certain point, and it's fairly early in the game, where you cannot get out of a situation unless you pay money. Like, until you pay money, you cannot move any further in this free-to-play game.
And this reminds me of EA's attempt at a mobile Dungeon Keeper, which put the...
That was rough.
It put the paywall so close to the intro to the game. And this is kind of the issue when you are working with an energy system. If you're not careful about it, if you're working with kind of... If you're not careful, you're telling people, don't play my game.
Well, that's why a lot of these free-to-play games do employ special in-game economists, mm-hmm. where they talk about the pros and cons, the benefits and the drawbacks of using different kinds of currency, so both in-game currency and real-world currency. There's a reason why there are people that are employed at these companies just for those reasons, to help balance those in-game economies. Like, it's really, really important, and it's important to balance whether or not you are going to draw a person in and keep them based on, okay, are we going to be altruistic about this, or are we going to keep giving, or are we going to put gates in the way, you know? Mm-hmm. And it's really just a matter of your audience. But a lot of people are disillusioned by those content gates.
Yeah. And the issue is now I think Battle Breakers, which is an Epic game, is the free to play game I played the most and spent the most money on, which again wasn't a lot of money, but I spent. I also spent on that really cool Marvel. Like, it was the Marvel Heroes in High School game. I spent a very little bit of money on that.
That was so funny.
So the thing about getting people to pay to continue playing in a mobile game is you need to give them enough that they know that they really like your game. And if I come in and I play my first game of The Culling and I don't have a good time,
I ain't coming back.
I'm not coming back. I'm certainly not coming back that day, and maybe I don't come back tomorrow. If I'm playing EA's Dungeon Keeper, which doesn't exist anymore, you know, if I can't play for 10, 20, 30, 40 minutes without feeling like that paywall ramp is getting steeper and steeper and steeper and suddenly it's a brick wall, I'm not coming back. And if I have to leave somebody in a perilous situation in Harry Potter and I can't pay to progress, then you force me to make a binary decision. I either pay you or I don't. And
I either play your game again
or I don't.
So, but this is also recognizing that we have to be cognizant of, you know, development costs. It mm-hmm. costs money to make sure, it costs money and time and resources to ensure that live ops games, like live service games, sorry, are up, mm-hmm. that they have that uptime availability. So the game no longer, so The Culling, getting back to The Culling no longer includes premium items or charges for crates. So they're not doing loot boxes or anything like that again.
Which is a whole other ball of wax.
It really is. That's a whole other conversation just in general. Yeah. So players can level up, earn crates, unlock airdrops through offline play only. What they did say, though, is that these changes that they are making, they are all being made in order to keep the game alive indefinitely. Mm-hmm. So what else are they doing?
I feel like that, well, part of the problem is they're wiping anybody. So they're starting from scratch again. So if you played The Culling a lot and you had a...
Oh, no.
Yeah. So you've lost all of your cosmetics. You've lost all of your unlocks. And that's going to be disappointing for some players. I don't know how many. But for some players, it's going to be disappointing. Now, I think the issue here is that, let's talk about Fortnite for just a second.
Yes.
The reason, you know, we talk about that Fortnite money, it's not because people were jumping in and paying to play multiple games of Fortnite a day.
Nope.
It's because the cosmetics, the battle pass, was a compelling reason to get people to come back in.
It's now, the same thing with League of Legends,
mm-hmm.
right? Like, yep. You are not necessarily going to be dropping in and spending a bunch of money on cosmetics to begin with. You have to learn to love the game first.
Yep. And I keep coming back to Fortnite because the battle pass includes activities. Oh, you have to go find these places to dance this week, and you need to go shoot these targets or these signs or these teddy bears or whatever that popped up, or you need to find this specific chest, or you just need to visit all of these places. It's not just about playing, liking the game, and then buying cosmetics. It's play the game, spend money once for the battle pass for the 10 weeks or so that the season runs, and earn a bunch of stuff. And that's the thing. You've got that reward system in there. It's not just that I spent the money. And even if I spent the money to buy the battle pass and boost my level to whatever, you know, you're still going in and you're earning some of those rewards and you feel that sense of accomplishment. You're going and you're checking those activities off of your list to increase your rank during that season. Little hits of serotonin, man. Exactly. So I think what the culling strategy misses is it misses that feedback loop. It's not just about playing the game. It's about playing the game and finding little bits of victory along the way, even if you're not scoring, in Fortnite's case, a victory roll. You can feel like you accomplished something in a match even if you get knocked out halfway through because, ha, I might have lost, but I wasn't really coming in here necessarily to get first place. I was coming in here to check off some of the objectives for the week.
Sure.
So I'm interested to see what happens with the culling. I know they're hoping to keep it running indefinitely, but I got to be honest. I look at this business model and I'm really confused by what they were thinking. And I hope I'm proven wrong. It'll be very interesting if I'm proven wrong. I hope that they're successful. And we wish the best. Wish Xavient the best. I like their work. I love the things that they've done. I think they've had some big challenges in recent years. But I hope this does work out for them.
All right. And speaking of loving video games and video game developers, mm-hmm. we especially love indie developers. We love them so much, so very much, that we really, really want you. If you are an indie developer of any kind, we are talking even about board games. If you yes. have a board game, a tabletop RPG, if you have something that you have been working on and you are ready to talk about it, if it is something that has been recently released or you're seeking funding or whatever, we want you to come talk to us for our indie spotlight. You can DM us. We are at Virtual Econcast, or you can send us an email at podcast@fsquared.biz.
Yes. And that about does it for this episode of Virtual Economy. This is episode, scrolling all the way to the top here, episode 18.
Oh my goodness, that's a lot of episodes.
Yes, which makes it our 19th episode because of our infamous 0th episode.
God, we're dumb.
Yeah, oh well. So thank you for listening. You can follow us on Twitter at @VirtualEconcast. I am at Footerish, F-U-T-T-E-R-I-S-H.
And I'm at Amanda Farrow. You can also subscribe to our RSS feed if you are brand new to us and you don't have us subscribed somewhere. We are virtualeconomy.libsyn, that's libsyn.com/RSS. We are on all major podcast networks, except for, I think, iHeartRadio. I think that's the only one that we're not on. So you can listen to us for free on Spotify, on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, Stitcher, Podcast Addicts, basically everywhere except for iHeartRadio, because mm-hmm. we're not old enough yet, I guess.
Aww.
I know, it's okay. Aww. But the best thing, if you do like what we're doing, if you like our content, if you like our approach to video game news, if you love our interviews, I know we do, you know, make sure that you subscribe. The yes. subscriptions tell the algorithm gods that, you know, maybe more people than just our mom love us.
Aww.
That's nice. Aww. I do like that our moms love us. Yes. But at the same time, we would really like it if the algorithms loved us too. Yeah. And you guys.
And speaking of things that we love listener questions. So if you have any questions about a contemporary piece of news, some headline that popped up, something for one of our interview guests, you can DM us at Virtual Econcast or shoot us an email at podcast@fsquared.biz. Also, I wanted to put a little plug in here. We formally announced earlier this week. So Virtual Economy is a labor of love.
It is.
And it is part of a grander effort that Amanda and I are working on. We started a business called F Squared.
We did. Which is why our @s are at fsquared.biz.
Yes. F Squared, we're doing consulting, and we've done a lot of pro bono work, and we'll continue to do pro bono work for up and coming developers who just need a quick pitch review or just have some quick business questions. We're glad to help. If you are listening and you're a developer and you need someone to consult on strategy, on messaging,
marketing. Pitch review,
marketing. We've done mock previews and mock reviews as well. If that is something that services that you might be interested in, please don't hesitate to visit our website at fsquared.biz. Or again, you can shoot us an email at hello@fsquared.biz.
We have so many email addresses.
We do. Or you can shoot us a DM on Twitter, of course.
Absolutely. So we will be back tomorrow with another episode, and this will be our interview with Ryan Canuel.
Yep, Petrichor Games. Looking forward to talking about, they are celebrating their 5th anniversary. They have a game coming out. But Petrichor is really interesting because they have leveraged non-games work to help fund their game development. And we'll be talking about that with Ryan on tomorrow's episode.
Absolutely. So in the meantime, wash your hands, stay hydrated, and be good to one another. We'll see you tomorrow.